Welcome to the Business Presenting Podcast, where we talk through the art and the science of business presenting with Tim Calkins. Tim's a professor at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management and author of the business presenting book, How to Wash a Chicken. I'm Abe Lebetkin, and on this podcast, we're unpacking key themes from that book. And Tim, we have come to the ninth and final episode, at least this time around, and the time has really flown by.
Well, it has. It's amazing to think we've already gone through eight of these, and we're going to wrap up this series, at least for the moment.
So today we're talking about handling questions, and we, I think, aptly are going to start with a question, which is, at the end of a presentation, or perhaps even during a presentation, are questions a good thing?
Well, I think in almost all cases, you really want questions in your presentation. You know, this is one of the ways that a business presentation is different than a keynote address at a big convention, and it's different than a TED Talk. In a business presentation, you really want to get people engaged. You want to connect with people. There's no better way to do that than to get people asking questions and responding to what they're seeing and getting their questions addressed right in the meeting. So as you put together a presentation, you really want to put that together and plan for questions. So for example, when you think about managing the time, you want to be sure that you've set aside enough time that you can take questions. If you plan to fill your whole 1 hour time slot with all of your slides, you've got no time for questions. That's not going to help you ultimately. You want to make sure you plan for that. The other thing is, as you set up a meeting, you should encourage people to ask questions and you should set expectations. You should say right up front, if you've got questions, let me know. We're going to address those as we go through the material. All of that is about engaging people, engaging your audience. You're much better off when you hear from people than when you don't.
So one part of it is blocking out the time and laying out expectations ahead of and at the start of a meeting. Then the other part of planning for and preparing for questions is thinking through what those responses will be and what questions make sense to try to elicit.
In most cases, you can anticipate the questions well ahead of time. And partly you do this because there are logical questions as you go through a recommendation that someone might have. You know, when you have a certain piece of information, you know people might ask, where did that information come from? Or how does it compare to a year ago? And you could sort of predict those. Also, if you've done a good job pre-selling your presentation, you'll have a sense for where the interesting points are, where the things people are intrigued by, confused with, things like that. All of that says you can predict pretty well where the questions are going to be in your presentation. And if you can predict the questions, then you can go ahead and prepare your answers. You know, the best question is one that you are ready to answer. You've thought through the proper response. You have the data. You have some information to answer that question. And there's really nothing like it in a presentation where you're presenting something, someone asks the question you knew they were going to ask, you have the answer ready to go, and you just hit that question right out of the park. There's no way to make you look more in command of your recommendation than to nail the questions. And the best way to do it is really try to anticipate them and get a sense about where the questions are going to be. Now, another thing you can do is you can almost plant questions in your presentation. And this is a little more sophisticated, but when you write a presentation, there are ways you can write it where you leave open a bit of a question. There's sort of an obvious point. You know, so for example, if you say, well, you know, things are going a lot better than the fiasco last year, well, you just invite the question around, well, what did happen last year? Take me through that. Or when you say, you know, we've learned so much from, you know, the recent experience with social media, and we're going to put all of that learning to use. Or you're just inviting the question about what was that learning. And planting questions is not a bad thing to do because you're just inviting the opportunity to really appear in command of your recommendation. So it's worth thinking about, you know, what questions are we going to get and what questions do we want to invite?
when it comes to planning and preparing for questions, how do you advise people think about this idea that sometimes comes up around getting people in the room to participate, getting people in the room to speak up early and sparking conversation, really, versus wanting people mostly to listen and then perhaps offer their commentary at the end?
You know, a lot of this goes back to understanding your audience, which is what we talked about way at the beginning of this podcast series. But a lot of it goes back to your audience and how do they like to interact with information. Now, some people you'll present to them and they love to jump in and they'll be jumping in with questions right from the very beginning. And it's a group of people that either the cultural norm of the organization or the individual preference, they love to jump in. Other times you're going to present to people where they really hold back. They don't lead with their questions. And that may be their preference, again, maybe their cultural norm. The first thing is just to be aware of that and be sensitive to it. In general, though, I think you like questions and you like questions sooner rather than later. You know, one of the things you can always think about is, you know, if you know there's going to be a question, do you want to preempt the question or not? And, you know, the issue is, do you want to say, well, you know, I know they're going to ask about this, so I might as well answer it ahead of time. That, I think, is something it's worth thinking through as you write your deck. There are times where you want to preempt the question. So if you know there's a logical question, you want to go ahead and answer it. Indeed, that's partly how you find the story in a presentation. But there are other times where you want to leave that open and you don't want to preempt every question. Because again, you want to get people involved. You want to get them talking about the topic and the questions help them do that.
I want to go now to a question that we've actually received on this subject, and it has to do with receiving difficult questions. We talked a moment ago about what to do if there's a question that you've prepared for. How about when there's a question that's really tough?
Well, you'll get these, and this is something that causes a lot of stress when people are presenting. You get these questions, and someone asks for a particular figure, and you don't know what it is, or they ask for a particular analysis, and you haven't done it. And it's these very difficult questions, which are hard to field mainly when you're not ready for them. In that case, I think you really have to think about what type of question it is and how much do you know. Now, it's always an option to pull the ripcord on a question. And when you pull the ripcord, what you say is, you know, I'm going to get back to you on that because I want to make sure I get you the right numbers. And I'm going to follow up on that just to make sure I come back. So I'll get in touch with you and follow up in the next couple of days. And that's the ripcord. If someone asks about some precise number in an analysis, you can always say, you know, I don't know that number offhand, but I can certainly get it and I'll circle back with you. And it's very fair to do that. The only thing about the ripcord is it doesn't strengthen your perception in the meeting. I mean, it's clearly you just pulled that ripcord and just got out of it. You also can't pull that too much. If every question has you saying, well, I'll have to follow up tomorrow or I'll get back to you later in the day. And boy, I don't know that one either. You really don't seem very in command of the situation. So pulling the ripcord's always an option. Sometimes a better approach, though, when you don't know an answer is just to give it your best shot. And when you give it your best shot, the key there is you want to know that you're in the general neighborhood. And then you want to make sure as you phrase your answer that you put some caveats around it. So if someone asks you, well, what was the revenue in 2017? And you really have just no idea. Well, you could say you have no idea, or you could say, you know, the revenue in 2017 was in the neighborhood of $50 million. Now, if you say in the neighborhood of $50 million, what you've really done there is you've given yourself a lot of room. I mean, $60 million is sort of in the neighborhood and $70 million, that's sort of in the neighborhood too, isn't it? And maybe even $80 million, I guess that's sort of close. I don't know. You've given yourself the ability to go back and check your number. You say it's in the neighborhood of $50 million. You follow up afterwards. If you find it was actually $120 million, then you just got to circle back and say, you know, it was in the neighborhood of 50, but that's where I thought it was. Turns out it actually won 20, more than I'd anticipated. So just wanted to get back to clarify that. So a little bit when it's a tough question, you have to think, do I know enough to get in the general area? And if I do, maybe I'll caveat my way into it. If I really don't know, sometimes I'm just better off to pull the ripcord and follow up later.
In your book, you outline some very important things to avoid, including one, I will say, that I am often guilty of, which is saying to someone as you're thinking about it and processing it, "That's a great question."
Oh, well, Abe, that is just such a great question you asked there. No, this is something people say all the time. And it is just one of those statements that you just shouldn't ever say. You know, you hear it all the time. "Oh, that's a great question. Such an interesting question." You know, the problem is with that is, you know, it's just filling space. The other problem is that it's a little, it obligates you to basically say the same thing to every question. I mean, if you ask a question and I say, "Well, Abe, that's just a great question." And then John asks a question and I don't say that. Well, then indirectly, I'm saying to John, "You know, that was sort of a stupid question there, John." And by the absence of it, I'm almost saying that. So when you say that's a great question, it seems like it's so productive. It seems like you're flattering the person answering the question. It certainly is giving you a little bit of time to think in your mind, but it doesn't move anything further. And it can really make you look sort of like a goofball. I saw a presentation the other day and someone was answering questions, but every question, you know, "That was a great question. You know, that's such an interesting question. That is a super question. Wow, that's so interesting, that question." And you're like, "This is ridiculous." And you don't look smart as a result. You never want to be judging people's questions. So you don't want to say, "That's a great question." Just try to skip that as much as possible. But there's other things to watch out for as well. You know, one of the things is very often when you get a question, especially a hard question, you're tempted to look away. And you look around the room, you glance this way, you glance that way. Generally, when you're answering a question, you want to stay looking at the person that asked the question. You start with them, you stay with that person, you keep your eyes on them. Then as you get into your answer, then you can look back at your slide or you can look around the room a little bit, but you want to be sure you circle back with that person. You want to make sure that they feel that you've answered their question. If they look like they're still confused, if they look unsatisfied, you want to keep going. You want to try to make sure that you've addressed their question to the best of your ability. So you want to stay on them and keep looking at them. You know, another thing you want to really be careful about doing is any sort of gesture, you know, or glance, rolling your eyes, looking at your watch. You know, all of these things are sort of indirectly insulting to the person asking the question. And that doesn't help you at all. It doesn't help the person asking the question. You're better off to just stay focused on the question, honor the question, answer it as best as you can, and then move on to the next one.
We talked about this a moment ago, but this concept of following up, there is some strategy and indeed some art to that. Let's talk about the right way to follow up after a meeting.
Well, so often you get done with the presentation and, you know, you've gone through all of these steps. I mean, they're like the last 8 sessions of this podcast. Everything from putting together your presentation brief to finding the story to assembling the slides to getting great data, getting everybody in the room, pre-selling it. The whole thing's exhausting. By the time you get to the end of it, you've answered those questions, all of that. It's tempting to say, "Wow, we got through that. We're done." And you're like, "Phew, that was such a relief." The reality is, though, that you're not done, and you almost are never done, because in companies, things don't end. I mean, the business keeps going, projects keep moving forward, new products have to be tracked and managed, and any presentation, it's not a one-time event. It's just part of a broader discussion, a broader project flow. So it's important to remember that the end of the meeting is not the end of a presentation, nor is it the end of the project. So, you know, for example, some things to keep in mind after the meeting is done, after the presentation is ended, in terms of follow through. Well, the first thing you want to do in terms of follow through is follow up on the questions. So if you had to pull the ripcord in that meeting and you had to tell somebody, "You know what, I'm going to follow up with you on that." Well, just remember to follow up. And if you do it promptly and you do it succinctly and you say, "You know, Abe, that in the meeting there, you'd asked me about the revenue number. I'd said it was in the neighborhood of $50 million, which is correct. Turns out it was 46.9. So I just wanted to make sure you had that number. If you have other questions, let me know. Now, that's just super follow-up, and it makes you look responsive on top of the numbers. That really enhances your brand in lots of ways. So the first thing you want to do is respond to questions. Oh, by the way, if you got a question wrong, you really want to follow up on that one. You know, if it turns out the revenues were actually, you know, $700 million and you weren't anywhere near, well, it's really good to follow up on that just to make sure they know the right number. The other thing you want to do in terms of follow-up, though, is to confirm the agreement that you came to in a meeting. So one of the most interesting times after a meeting is the period right after, as people leave the room, and then the next 24 hours, because after a meeting, there's all this spin. It's a little bit like after a presidential debate. You know, the debate ends, and then all the managers, the campaign managers, and the aides all spend this time and say, oh, you know, our candidate did so good and really won that debate, and that was just tremendous, wasn't it? And they're trying to spin it to sort of shape perceptions of it. And there's a little bit of this that goes on after a business meeting as well. So what you want to do is make sure you retain control of the discussion. And the way you do that is to very quickly send out a recap of the key points. And so if there was an agreement, and if you heard an agreement to proceed with the new social media campaign, well, then you want to very quickly say, you know, as that was a lively discussion yesterday, I just wanted to recap the conclusion. We are going to roll with the social media campaign that is going to come out at the 1st of August. It's going to involve a spend of $22 million. And then you just recapped it. Now, if anybody remembers differently, if they misremembered perhaps, then you've just highlighted the issue. So you make sure you've sort of reclaimed ownership of the narrative and of the conclusions. So confirming the decision is really good. The other thing that's really important to do is to reflect a bit on the presentation. And what's always good to do is to look back and really look at what happened. If the presentation went well, why did it go well? What worked? And if the presentation didn't go so well, what didn't work? And in any presentation, there's always opportunities to do things better. And there's always things that went well. So it's worth looking at that and trying to really learn from it. You know, presenting is one of these things that it's never perfect and we're never done and we're always trying to get better. I don't think there's ever been a perfect presentation in the history of business, really. But the result is that there's always things we can learn. And so one of the things that's really important to do after a presentation is to spend the time and think back. And you can do that on your own. That's one way to do it, is to spend some time on your own thinking about it. But you can also do it with colleagues. And you could say, you know, boy, looking at that presentation, how did it go? What advice would you have? What seemed to work? What didn't work too well? And all of that is great feedback. And you become a better presenter over time through experience, but also through really learning from your experience. I find the same thing works in my classes at Kellogg. You know, when I'm at my best, really, I am always learning from a class session. And after each class session, I reflect a little bit about how did the time go and what seemed to work in that class and what can I do next time when I teach the same topic? How do I make sure I do it as well or make sure that I do it better? And that's really when things improve. That's how we learn. That's how we get better.
Over the course of this podcast, we've gotten a number of questions from listeners and from others who you've talked with as you've been discussing the book, How to Wash Your Chicken. I want to cover a few of those here. One of them that has surfaced a number of times is around virtual meetings and to what extent the elements that we've been talking about here apply to a video meeting or to a phone call?
Well, more and more meetings are now virtual, where we're not sitting in the same room. And sometimes that's true even when you're in the same city, because there might be some people at one office and some other people at another office, and they're getting together virtually on a system. And two thoughts on that. One is that all the basic approaches still apply. It is still about having a clear recommendation and having a presentation brief and understanding who we're talking to and understanding all of that. But very important. It's really essential to understand what is the platform we're dealing with, because that shapes how we write a presentation. And you go way back to the presentation brief. You know, one of the big questions, is it an in-person meeting? Is it a virtual meeting? And even if it's a virtual meeting, well, what kind of meeting is it really? Is this a meeting we're going to be doing on a conference call? Is this a meeting where we're going to have a video hookup? Is this a webinar kind of format? You know, it's quite different, because if it's a purely voice meeting, that has certain implications on what you can do and what you can't do. If, on the other hand, it's a meeting where you will be able to see slides, sort of webinar style, well, that's a different dynamic, and that gives you the ability to do different things. And if it's a meeting where you can actually see the other people, that's different as well. So you want to really think through, what is the system we're going to be working with for this presentation? Very important with a lot of these virtual systems, though, is that the one thing they sort of all have in common is that it is very hard to keep someone's attention. Now, it's hard to keep someone's attention when you're sitting there right with them. It's hard over the dinner table with my son to keep him paying attention to anything we talk about. But it's a lot harder when you're not in the same room with a person. You know, it's hardest on a conference call, I think. But then these webinars are very close. People are out of there very soon. So you want to think about the system. You want to think about the platform. Think about what that's going to mean. More than anything, though, what I think it means is that you've got to get to the point very, very quickly. People will tune out so fast that if you don't very quickly say, here's the recommendation, here's the data, here's the point, let's get to the discussion, you're going to lose people, they're not going to pay attention, and you're not going to get the engagement you need to get commitment to the project.
Another one of the questions that has come up is, what do you do if there's disagreement in the room, either disagreement between two or more people who are listening to the presentation, or potentially disagreement between people in the room and yourself?
Well, ideally, you would know about disagreement before you get in the room. You know, so if you've pre-sold your presentation, you've gotten out there, you've talked to people, if there's real conflict, you should know about it before you get in there. And then when you walk in, if you know there's disagreement, that's okay. Because if you know people are going to be fighting about a certain topic, well, you can build your presentation knowing that there's going to be a fight. So for example, you could lay out your presentation and say, there are two ways to look at this issue. There's A and there's B. And those are the two sides of the debate. And the people supporting A will nod their head. And then the people supporting B will nod their head. And then you've got different options. You could say, given the two options, we really think A is the ideal way to go for the following reasons. Or you could say, one of the things we have to address today is to figure out, do we want to go with A or with B? And there's different ways you could design your presentation. When you get in the room and you find there's conflict that you didn't expect developing, that is a trickier area to manage. What you really want to try to understand is, what is the source of the disagreement? And is the disagreement coming from a difference in objectives? Is it coming from a different understanding of the situation? Is it coming from a different set of priorities? You want to try to probe to figure out what that is. Now, ideally, you'll reach some agreement in the room. That sometimes is wishful thinking, though. What you may need to do is, you may need to say, worst case, you could say, you know, this is clearly a hot issue. What I'd like to do is to sit down with both of you separately and figure out, how do we reach resolution on this? And again, it's pulling that ripcord, but sometimes if you know you're not going to get these people to agree, that's what you're going to have to do. It's another step in your journey, but to get agreement, sometimes that's going to be your best road forward.
On the note of making peace, we come toward the end of this last installment of the podcast. Before we wrap up, any final thoughts?
Well, I think presenting is, you know, such an important task. And you go back to where we started the whole podcast about why does presenting matter. And I think it is more and more our ability to present our ideas clearly and crisply and find a way to sift through all the data in the world. what happens is it really is an important skill to have an impact, to sell our ideas, to build our brands. And so my hope through the podcast, through the book, through all of the different things that we've done, is that people will find these ideas useful and that by employing them, they'll be able to communicate a little more crisply and a little more cleanly and have a little greater impact in their career and with their ideas. And I think if you practice and if you work at it and you do a lot of these things that are basic fundamental things, it's really going to work.
Tim, it's been fantastic doing this podcast with you. And if folks want to continue the conversation, what's the best way for them to reach out to you?
Well, Abe, it's been such a pleasure to work with you on this as well. And you've been terrific at guiding our conversations and providing insights. So thank you for all of that. To continue the conversation, and the journey goes on, a lot of different ways to do that. Website at timcawkins.com or howtowashachicken.com or Twitter at Timothy Cawkins, or you can connect on LinkedIn. Lots of different ways to connect. And indeed, you know, I think presenting, it's not something you do when you're done. It's this ongoing journey. Every presentation is another opportunity to learn.